You won't have a comprehensive agreement that will solve the conflict once and for all. A comprehensive agreement, or an agreement itself, is a stepping stone towards a long-term settlement. But it's the implementation of that agreement and possibly new agreements following the implementation of that agreement that is the solution. So the solution is a long-drawn period of time. It's not one signature on a paper.
Welcome to Babel, Translating the Middle East, a podcast from the Middle East program at CSIS. Here on Babel, we take you beyond the headlines to take a closer look at what's happening in the Middle East and why it matters. This week on Babel, I speak with Hans Grunberg, the UN's Yemen envoy. We talk about what a UN mediator does, why successful mediation is about more than just reaching a peace agreement, and how the internationalization of conflicts around the globe complicates those efforts. Then I continue the conversation with Natasha Hall and Leah Hickert to discuss the trade-offs between different mediators and why the United Nations separates its humanitarian work from its mediation efforts. To translate some of what's happening in the Middle East, this is Babel. Hans Grunberg is currently the UN Special Envoy of the Secretary General for Yemen, a position he's served in since 2021. Hans, welcome to Babel.
Thank you very much. Real pleasure to be with you.
So you are basically a mediator sent by the UN to mediate this long-running conflict in Yemen. What's a mediator do?
Usually when you think about mediation in the most simplified version, you have two parties that are often at war with one another. And mediation is a process whereby a third party assists with their consent, prevent, manage, or resolve the conflict by helping them to develop a mutually acceptable agreement. And that, I think, is a very simplified version of what mediation is. And you will realize that it's a complicated task. And reality is much more complex than that, and especially it's getting more and more complex in the world that we're living in. So often you're not seeing two parties, you have a multiple set of parties, and parties are often fragmented, and even more so you will see the involvement of the region and some international parties as well. And basically, it's not only mediating between two parties, it's about engaging in serious and as concrete discussions as possible with not only the parties, but a number of different interlocutors in order to move the needle or move the process in one coherent and long-term fashion. Then there's another concept that you mediate between parties with their consent. And consent is a complicated term as well. And consent is essentially about trust. And trust is also something that you want to develop between the mediator and the parties, but you also want to develop it between the mediator and the stakeholders, between the mediator and the international community, the members of the Security Council, some of the members in the region, and other interlocutors that you're engaging with. And that trust is long-term, and it's a complicated thing because it requires a long-term investment. It's a very exhaustive thing to develop, and you can lose it very quickly.
Why is the Yemen problem a problem the UN should be mediating? What are the characteristics that make the UN the proper mediator as opposed to people just fighting out a war?
Well, there's nothing that says that the UN has a monopoly on mediation. But there is an advantage of having the UN as mediator. And the reason is that you get some long-term approach from the United Nations. You get an organization that will engage on a certain conflict with a long-term vision in mind that won't change depending on the situation in the world. But also, I think the additional values that you have using the United Nations as a mediating entity is the fact that it's the only universal intergovernmental organization there is. And with that comes a certain relative impartiality. And I mean it, relative impartiality, because the impartiality will always be contested. But you will not find a party that is more impartial than the United Nations. When I mediate, I represent the global community. In fact, when I mediate in Yemen, my interest is the people of Yemen, is the well-being of the people of Yemen. I'm not mediating for any other interest.
What tools do you have as a UN mediator? When we think about states, states have armies they can deploy, they can give economic incentives, they have sanctions. States are used to trying to influence other states, other groups. you're from the UN, which, as you said, you have trust. There's the good offices, but what tools do you have to both reward and punish people who might be a little reluctant to get to the agreement they need to get to?
You enter into something important here, and the United Nations is not a power broker. I do not have the tools of forcing parties to agree by using means of force. That is something that I, as a UN mediator, cannot do. That means that the tools that I have at my disposal is, again, it is the concept of impartiality that allows me to get access to parties that several other representatives of the international community might not or cannot or will not want to engage with. Then again, if I do my work correctly enough, if I do find agreement with the members of the Security Council on the way forward, I can use that unity within the Security Council and within the bodies that the United Nations have at its disposal to help accompany and put pressure on the implementation of a possible peace agreement. And that is exactly what we're trying to do. Obviously, at this particular given moment, when the number of conflicts are multiplying and the divisions on the global level are getting deeper, the ability to reach unity within the Council is becoming more complex. And that is also a large part of the work that the mediator does, making sure that the tools that you have at your disposal are as efficient as possible.
Without violating confidences of your current negotiations, could you talk a little bit about the interrelationship between the parties on the ground in Yemen, regional actors, global actors? I mean, how do those talks relate to each other and how are they distinct?
Here, it comes back a bit to your first question about what the mediator does and doesn't do. And this is very true in the concept of the mediation efforts that we're doing in Yemen. And it's also interrelated with a number of other questions, other conflicts that are being mediated. And the simplified version I mentioned earlier about mediation being between parties is not there. The more accurate description of what we're having is a multitude of different interrelated discussions that are taking place on different levels, but also between different bodies, not only necessarily between me as the main mediator, but on different levels. I met a couple of months back a professor at Edinburgh University. Her name is Christine Bell. She introduced a concept called multi-mediation. And it's an interesting concept because it's making sure that in a situation where you have these multitude of different discussions and negotiations, you ensure that they are geared towards one common goal. And that means that mediation is not only mediating between the parties, but it's also very much about coordinating efforts on the way forward so that we make sure that there is one, and all of this relies on the necessity to have one main mediator. If you don't have one main mediator, multi-mediation withers down into a situation where the parties might go into forum shopping. So in the case of Yemen, there is clear, active, ongoing, concrete discussions with the parties that are also added and helped through discussions that the region are having with the parties. But that can only be effective if these discussions are being fed to myself and to my office so that we can put them into the broader context. And that brings me back again to the concept of trust. If those regional interlocutors don't trust me as the mediator, they will not feed the type of information that I need in order to be effective. So it's all these notions that are interrelated and interdependent.
It feels like this has changed from the way I remember mediators in the past. Is this evolving? How quickly is it evolving? Where do you think it's evolving toward?
There is a need for broader mediation to update itself and get in tune with the current complex geopolitical environment that we're facing. And there's a lot of thinking going on in numerous academic institutions in terms of how to make sure today's mediation is updated given the complexity that we're facing. One thing that I think is clear is that we're moving into a multipolar world where conflicts today are not the type of conflicts that we saw yesterday. And that means that solutions today will not be the type of solutions that we saw yesterday. One key aspect, though, and that I think has been true even before, but that we understand much better today, is the whole concept that it's not the agreement that is the solution. Often you talk about we want a comprehensive agreement in order to solve the conflict in Yemen, for example. You won't have a comprehensive agreement that will solve the conflict once and for all. a comprehensive agreement or an agreement in itself is a stepping stone towards a long-term settlement, but it's the implementation of that agreement and possibly new agreements following the implementation of that agreement that is the solution. So the solution is a long-drawn period of time. It's not one signature on a paper. And I think that this is critical if you want to also value success when it comes to mediation.
Could you talk about how you see conflict changing and continuing to change?
What we're seeing today is a situation where conflicts are being more internationalized and where the regions are drawn into conflicts that previously might have been very local or national. You often talk about proxy wars, and that is, from my point of view, an oversimplification of what we're seeing. It's not about proxy wars. It's about national conflicts that are gradually expanded into the region and then draws the attention of the global international community. And that then plays into a broader set of conflict lines that you have on the global stage. And that's why it's so important that we settle and that we engage and that we try to settle conflicts as early as possible so that they are not being dragged into this very complex situation that we have on a global level or even on a regional level. In the case of Yemen, my mediation is to make sure that the conflict finds a just resolution and that the Yemeni population can once and for all believe that the war is not coming back and that they have a possibility to normalize their life. But obviously that is also hopefully in the interest of the region and the interest of the global community. That's the upside, but that can also be met by a negative spiral where you use the situation in Yemen to your benefit and then it's drawn into to something broader and more complex and much more difficult to resolve.
You've described a complex problem that in many ways is becoming more complex. What kind of team do you have to move forward? I understand you have about 100 people, a bunch of them do security and logistics, but what's your intellectual team like? How do you structure it and what are they doing?
I might be the face of the mediation in Yemen, but it's a team effort. In my office, I have around 20 to 25 people working on substance, and they are divided into different sections. One is a section that deals with following and engaging with the Yemenis on the political level. One team is engaging on the economic dimension of the conflict. One team is engaging on the military and the security aspect of the conflict. And then I have a senior gender advisor to follow and make sure that we address the notion of inclusivity in the resolution of the conflict. So as you realize, this team is there and in place to ensure that we have the capacity to assist the Yemenis in the difficult negotiations that will follow a possible agreement. And that is what I have on a daily basis. Then obviously you have additional support in the United Nations headquarters in New York, which has its mediation support unit. And you have also the Department for Political Affairs in New York that we are in close touch, which also contributes to the work that we do. But all of this is there in order to generate clear ideas on how this mediation process needs to continue. So just one example is on how I began my mediation efforts a couple of years back. One of the first things that I did was to gather the substantive team that I enumerated, and we had a two-day session and we talked about how to establish a long-term vision on what to achieve that can be acceptable by all sides and also by the international community. And the difficulty of getting to that formulation was about finding something that is equally realistic, but also something that the parties are not shied away by. Because you can formulate something that is utterly unrealistic and that everyone can agree upon, but you can also formulate something that is slightly more realistic, but then the more realistic it becomes, the more difficult it might be to find the buy-in. And that gives you the long-term direction of the work that you want to do. And then comes the day-to-day basis when you start engaging on the hard work in trying to steer all your efforts, but also the other stakeholders' efforts towards that goal.
It's notable to me that you didn't talk about the humanitarian aspect, which is a large part of the discussion in Washington and around the world about the conflict in Yemen. As I don't need to tell you, many Yemenis are food insecure. There are challenges of disease, and there are concerns that some of the combatants are trying to manipulate humanitarian assistance to advance their war aims. What's the connection between the political work you're doing, the military work you're doing, and the humanitarian concerns that have seized a lot of people in the UN system and around the world?
Obviously, I think one needs to be careful in order to allow humanitarian actors to be able to deliver their humanitarian support as much as possible, to mix politics with the humanitarian action. And that I think is necessary. And that's been clear in Yemen as well, where despite challenges, as you highlighted, the United Nations and other humanitarian actors have been reasonably good in delivering humanitarian support to the Yemeni population. But obviously the needs are enormous, and they are unfortunately still vast. And that is something that I would have wanted to see a change a long time ago. And I would have wanted to see Yemen transition from a constant need of humanitarian support towards a more development-oriented need, where you can allow donors to engage on a more long-term development and reconstruction support to Yemen. But for that to happen, and this is where the intersection comes in, if you want a country to transition, there is an absolute need for a settlement of the conflict. And that settlement needs to be structured, and it needs to also get the broader support of the international community, if you want the international community to be helpful in that transition. Otherwise, you might reach what we have right now, which is an informal truce, but you might not get that much further in the efforts that you're doing. And that's why it's so important that we do move forward on getting an agreement in place, because that will also hopefully facilitate not only the delivery of humanitarian support, but also the transition from humanitarian to a more development-oriented support that Yemen would be in need of.
You've been in this position for about 3 years. What are some of the new approaches you're taking because of what you've learned on the job?
Well, I think that when you look at what characteristics that mediator should have, you often talk as quite straightforward answers, such as the concept of impartiality, of communication skills and problem-solving abilities. And that goes without saying, and that is pretty straightforward. But following these 3 years, there are, I would say, other, in my view, even more important qualities that I am not at all saying that I represent, that I at every day try to aspire towards. One is empathy. The concept of empathy is critical. If you can't show a certain amount of empathy, or show the parties that you actually do feel with the country or with the issue that you are dealing with, you will not get the amount of trust needed to be able to deliver solutions to the parties to resolve their conflict. And that's why you cannot allow yourself to allow that empathy to wind off. You constantly need to remind yourself and to feel about the issues that you're working on. And that the other quality that is critical as well is integrity. You need to show that you are someone you can rely on, and that you're not representing any other interest than the interest of the population at stake. That level of integrity is complicated in a world where the world views are on collision. And this is a simplification, obviously, where the liberal world order is met with a competing world order. And there, I think that the concept of integrity becomes even more important. And finally, is the concept of courage. You need to be able to present ideas, solutions to the parties that you are aware will not always be met with their liking. And you need to be courageous enough to tell large countries, sometimes world powers, things that they don't want to hear. And if you're not courageous enough to do that, you won't get the results that you want. And again, I'm not saying that I am representing all these traits, but I'm saying that I've tried to aspire towards them.
And your preparation was, you studied economics, you were in business before you became a diplomat. You weren't a Middle East studies nerd. You didn't read 300 books. How did business prepare you, and what other background do you wish you had to do this work effectively?
If you look at my career until now, it's been a combination of the private sector, and the work in diplomacy is focused on the Middle East. So obviously there's a basic understanding, and I won't say full, but there's a basic understanding of the situation in the Middle East that follows from years of having worked and lived inside the Middle East. When it comes to the notion of mediation and negotiation, I think the stunt in the private sector in the beginning of my career was a very good school, because it is a hard school where you enter into negotiations that are often tough, but also direct, and where you learn how to approach things. But then coming into the experience that I had from the European Union has also been a fantastic experience, in terms of that within the European Union, you have a constant negotiation and constant mediation among member states to reach compromises and the way forward. I've been part of the diplomatic corps, where your role is to make sure that 27 member states are in agreement on a way forward, and you seek agreements and also concrete solutions to complex situations. But coming back to the difference between mediation and negotiation, I think that you can't be effective in mediation unless you understand negotiation. And that, I think, is critical.
Heinz Grünberg, thank you very much for joining us on Babbel.
Thank you.
Hans mentioned that the internationalization of conflicts has made mediation more complicated. Where have we seen that happen in the Middle East?
Well, the most obvious is the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict that started off as a regional conflict and has continued. You certainly have had issues with the Iranians reaching into a number of places in conflict, and we see that in Yemen, we see it in Iraq, we see it elsewhere. Libya is another place where the UN has been trying to mediate, and you have any number of international actors who are involved in Libya. So it feels that he's right, that as we look at the more modern conflicts, a number of them seem to have very strong international components. But it also feels like the Middle East started off having a number of these. And of course, another example is the Lebanese Civil War, which brought in any number of international actors and was a place where Arab states were fighting a Cold War on Lebanese soil.
It's kind of sad, actually, because you could argue that the internationalization of these conflicts could be beneficial in a less polarized world. More attention could mean more aid, a greater desire to resolve them, as we saw during the Madrid peace process. But unfortunately, I think today we have a lot of international actors with very different goals. And those goals are not always a peaceful and just end to the conflict. I think aid and negotiated ceasefires tend to somewhat bend to the will of certain warring parties. And these days, it tends to be the warring parties with the most committed international benefactors. And I think we should all be worried about this, not just UN mediators like Hans, but humanitarian agencies and others, because these people that are trying to do good things will increasingly be used as tools in that kind of game.
Let's talk more about these different actors. What are the trade-offs when a conflict is mediated by the United Nations rather than a specific group of states or even a single powerful state?
As Hans mentioned, with the UN mediator, you have someone who is supposed to be impartial and has the interests of the people in mind. It's incredibly challenging, though, for a UN mediator to do anything if they aren't empowered by the stakeholders in the conflict. Syria is a prime example of this. You have a multitude of major international and regional powers involved, including the US, European countries, Russia, Iran, Turkey, and they all seem somewhat uncommitted to the UN Security Council resolution to drive the country towards a just and acceptable political transition. They're either actively sabotaging it, or they're not doing anything to get the warring parties to the table. And so the UN mediator, in this case, Geir Pedersen, we've gone through a few though in Syria, are really only as effective as these warring parties or these stakeholders allow him or her to be. Because if he can't put certain carrots and sticks on the table, like sanctions, because the warring parties won't address them, then there's really little he can do to change anyone's calculus. That's why you have scholars like Steve Heidemann calling the UN peace process for Syria zombified, because you have actors on both sides conducting their own dialogues outside of UN mediation efforts, like the Astana process shepherded by Russia.
But it does seem to me that this issue of being able to supply carrots and sticks, which states by their nature have, really distinguishes it. I think what might be going on in Yemen is because the Saudis have traditionally put a lot of resources into Yemen. If he can align with the Saudis, that can give him the resources of a state without the necessary direct involvement of a state in the mediation. But it requires him, as he said, to maintain the trust and confidence of the Houthis and the Saudis and other parties. How you do that over time is extraordinarily difficult. Most conflicts require state buy-in, and the UN doesn't start off as a state. It needs to elicit the buy-in of others rather than supply the carrots or sticks. And that means you have to convince somebody who's not directing the negotiation that the negotiation is going to serve their interests and they should support it. It gives you some advantages, but it's hard because the easiest thing is to have a president of the United States say, well, we're not going to miss $500 million, which for an organization like the UN is hard to come up with, but for the US government is not so difficult.
What I fear now is that you have at least three strong world powers with a bigger stake in these conflicts, and often that stake is to stick it to the other world power. And you have rising middle powers like Iran and Turkey that are essentially doing the same. And that's making it far harder for an actor like a UN mediator to be really effective.
Something else that struck me was when Hans mentioned that his team engages with the political, economic, and military dimensions of the Yemeni conflict, but not the humanitarian dimension. Why might the United Nations want to keep its humanitarian efforts separate from its mediation efforts?
So I found that interesting, but not very surprising. I think that that is a mistake, but it's a common one. These conflicts are lasting years, if not decades, and they rarely end just by diplomatic means. That means that the drivers of the conflict remain, even if you get warlords to put down their weapons. And then the country is still fragile, and that's why we're seeing such high recidivism in conflict. I mean, how long have we been talking about Israel, Palestine, Sudan, DRC, Chad, Myanmar? And in the meantime, these humanitarian aid actors remain, and they're desperately trying to make the best of a terrible situation, which tends to get more terrible as donor fatigue sets in. The issue remains that humanitarian aid can't really solve the conflict, but it tends to be one of the last avenues that we actually engage with these conflicts. And if it is the only way that we are actually engaging with these conflicts, it needs to be used over the years in a way where it's not exacerbating the drivers of conflict.
You did that report on rescue aid in Syria, and you talked about the way that the Syrian government instrumentalizes international assistance to drive its own side in the conflict. To me, it was a little bit surprising that there wasn't engagement in part because of the ways in which combatants sometimes do try to use humanitarian assistance to drive its side of the conflict. And unless mediators are attuned to the way that's happening, you can inadvertently be contributing to that rather than diminishing it.
It would seem to me that negotiating for better terms for aid programming early on and consistently would probably yield better outcomes and at least ensure that those ongoing conflict dynamics don't shift so dramatically that peace becomes impossible. Because really what we always end up seeing is these grand bargains sometimes at the end of conflicts, like the Lebanese Civil War. But the conflict dynamics are in such a state that the aid that goes in tends to reward those same warring parties.
Thank you for joining me, John and Natasha.
Thank you, Leah.
Thanks, Leah.
Thanks for listening to Babbel. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find more analysis on this topic linked in the show notes on the CSIS website, and you can find us on Twitter at CSIS Mideast. Thank you.